From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with actor Peter Falk. He died Thursday at the age of 83. He was known to TV viewers around the world as Columbo, the disorganized and seemingly inept detective who managed to take people by surprise when he figured out who committed the murder.
Just one more thing.
We'll talk with Falk about his acting career and about what it was like to grow up with a glass eye.
You could always get people's attention if you took a spoon and tapped it.
Oh, gosh. Also, we talk with Philadelphia Inquirer education reporter Martha Woodall about her ongoing series into fraud, mismanagement, and conflicts of interest in charter schools. 19 of the 74 charter schools operating in the Philadelphia area are under federal investigation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Peter Falk, who was known around the world for his portrayal of Columbo in the NBC TV series, died Thursday at the age of 83. We're going to listen back to an interview with him. Falk also had a movie and stage career. He was directed by John Cassavetes in Husbands and A Woman Under the Influence. He won a Tony for his performance in Neil Simon's Broadway show, Prisoner of Second Avenue. In his role as Columbo, Falk became synonymous with the word rumpled. On Google, I found 683,000 results that had both the words Columbo and rumpled. Columbo was a detective in the L.A. Police Department who seemed so disorganized, distracted, yet polite, in his rumpled raincoat that he appeared harmless, but he always solved the murder. The first time Falk played Columbo was in a 1968 made-for-TV movie called Prescription Murder. Here's a scene from the film with Falk and Gene Barry.
Well, listen, there's one more thing. You don't remember what your wife was wearing that night, do you?
Well, Carol had so many dresses. Is it important?
Well, yes, in a way it is.
Let's see now. Oh, yes, she was wearing a blue wool dress with brass buttons, if I'm not mistaken.
That's what the stewardess said. She's back in town, by the way, and I spoke to her, and she told me your wife was wearing a blue wool dress with blue kid gloves.
Well, and that's probably it.
No. That's funny, though. If she came home from the airport, what did she do with the dress and gloves? When we went over your apartment last week, we couldn't find them.
Well, they may have been stolen.
Yeah, maybe. Did you put those on the list of stolen items?
Really, Lieutenant, how could you expect me to notice they were missing?
Still, it's puzzling when you think about it. I mean, why would a guy steal a dress and a pair of gloves? What are they worth?
People don't always do the rational thing.
Oh, they sure don't. You learn a lot about that in my line. Well, I guess you do in yours, too.
I spoke with Peter Falk in 1995.
What was the part of Columbo like when you first read it?
It was very good. It was somebody that I immediately wanted to play. But the basic thrust of a guy appearing less than he actually is, that was always there.
Mm-hmm.
And that disarming quality of not ever appearing formidable was always there. I think that when we started to make the series, they would often write scenes that were supposed to be humorous. And those are the ones that made me very, very nervous.
Why?
Because I didn't think they were funny. They were kind of cute. So I would tamper with those all the time to make sure that they were funny, that they were humorous, not funny, and that they were more subtle and more believable. And the other thing that I guess I insisted upon was that I think that he is by birth a polite man. But he's also canny, so he's not above using his politeness. But the fact that he is polite makes it easier for him to play polite. And the other thing that used to bother me about the early scripts, was in the final scene, if you had what actors used to refer to as Moshe the Explainer scenes. And that's when the detective, he takes two pages, he talks for two pages and he explains everything that happened. And as the actor, you can hear the people snoring. You know the audience is tuned out. They're not interested. So the trick is to have that final scene remain a scene and have the cat and mouse going back and forth. And the audience plus the villain, they don't know what in the hell this guy's driving at, but they're interested. You show them just enough to keep them interested, keep them guessing what is he going to do. And when you finally nail the guy, that should be the end of the show. It should be about three lines after that, and that's it. It was things like that that used to... And clues. The clues can't be transparent. And if they're obvious to the audience, then he's not Sherlock Holmes.
I like the way you described Columbo as looking like less than he actually is. That's something that's easy to identify with. Did you identify with that?
I've always been sloppy all my life. I never could keep myself together. And I am in person a bit misty. I can't keep an umbrella more than 3 days. That was when I used to live in New York. You'd lose it and lose everything. And frequently walk in the walls. So I understood that quality. And I am a slow thinker. I am attracted to ambiguity. I'm not somebody that has black and white answers to everything. And that kind of fits in with Columbo. So the slowness and the methodicalness and the sloppiness, that was all very easy for me.
And of course, I should ask you about the raincoat, Columbo's raincoat, which I believe you bought.
Well, there was a dispute over that because I...
What, over who really bought it?
No, the dispute was... I always said that I read that in the script, but Lincoln Levinson said, no, it wasn't in the script. But I seem to remember seeing it in the script, so whatever it is. I did buy it, but I didn't buy it at the time. I had already had it, but I said, this is what I want to wear. And I knew what I wanted to wear underneath it, too. I wanted everything to be tan and brown altogether. A little dash of dull green in the tie. And that's about as flashy as he got. And the suit that fitted me the least was a seersucker, kind of seersucker blue and white. So I said, dye that. And they dyed it and got out all that white, whatever the hell it was, I don't remember, but it had to be dyed. And that became tan, and the shoes were mine, too. They were a pair of shoes I picked up in Italy, I don't know, a long time ago. They happened to be fairly expensive shoes, handmade shoes, but they were very comfortable, and they were clunky.
And that was important, clunky?
Clunky was important, yeah.
For that sense of being slightly uncoordinated?
I think he always wanted that contrast because the people that he was going after, they were always...
wealthy.
They were always, yes, God's chosen. I mean, they all had long necks and they all could buy suits off the rack and it fitted them and they looked good and... their teeth were white, and they had dough, and they spoke well, and so clunky shoes were a good contrast.
I have one more Columbo question for you. Do you think that your long association with that character has worked for you, against you, both in the other part of your career, the part outside of Columbo?
Well, I always say the same thing, Terry.
Say it again.
I'll say it again. Being known as Columbo, and it ain't cancer. So, I make a lot of dough, and the listeners, you know, I think it's difficult for the average person to say, what's he complaining about that he's typecast? Who the hell cares? I mean, he does make a lot of money, and he gets good seats in restaurants, and so I don't feel that that's something that people are really interested in, but... To answer your question, I think arguably I probably would be a better actor if I hadn't spent so much time playing that one role. I think that kind of diversity and that kind of challenge, I might be a better actor. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think probably I would be, but so what?
We're listening back to a 1995 interview with Peter Falk. He died Thursday at the age of 83. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my 1995 interview with Peter Falk. He died Thursday at the age of 83. He was known to TV viewers around the world as Columbo. He also had a stage and film career. Here's a scene from the 1974 film A Woman Under the Influence, which was directed by John Cassavetes and starred Falk and Jenna Rollins. She played a suburban housewife with two children who's having an emotional breakdown. Falk played her husband, who loves her, but is worried sick about what's happening to her.
You're going to be committed. Go on to the hospital until you get better.
I'm not sore at you. I mean, you hit me. You never did that before. Feel that if that's what you feel bad about. I always understood you, and you always understood me, and that was always just how it was, and that's it. Till death do us part, Nick, you said it. Remember, he said, do you, Mabel Mortensen, take this man? I do, Nick. I do. Remember, I said, it's going to work because I'm already pregnant.
Don't let that mind run away on you now.
Do you remember how you laughed?
Don't make
it. You laughed. Don't. Don't you remember it? And he was so mad as a big toad.
Don't do that.
Hey, don't be sad. I know you love me.
Let me switch gears to another aspect of your acting career, and I'm thinking of the long association you had with the actor and director John Cassavetes. What struck you as different about his approach to directing
everything,
than what you were used to?
Everything. Everything John did was original. Everything. Every bone in his body was original. He was the most fertile man I've ever met. I'll never meet anyone as fertile as he was.
When you improvise with Cassavetes in a movie, what was the process of improvisation like?
There's much less improvisation in his movies than people think. I could make a lot of money if I would bet somebody. I said, you point out the scenes to me that are improvised, and when you're wrong, you pay me, and when you're right, I'll pay you. You can't tell the difference between what's improvised and what isn't improvised in John's scenes. John introduced a new standard of spontaneity, a new standard of spontaneous behavior in acting. Nobody did that before. He started that. There were times when John would want you to improvise. There are other times where it was strictly written and you were expected to follow the script.
Working with Cassavetes, did that bring out a certain spontaneity in you?
Oh, yeah, if it did. If it took me a long time to trust him. Because actors, we have our own idea about how we act. And you rely on... technique has a lot to do with acting. Technique has a lot to do with the craft of acting. And that's the one thing John didn't want to... I mean, he didn't want you to be technical, even in the best sense. You can get an actor who is an extremely capable for technical actor, and nobody can tell the difference.
Well, it strikes me with Cassavetes movies, one of the many things that make them different is that there's a lot more, everything's slower, there's more space around actions and words, there's silences and pauses and... just a lot of room, and I was wondering if that made it made you pace yourself differently in a performance, knowing that the camera was going to be on you maybe for a longer time, and in moments that to another director might seem like an off moment and not an on moment.
Yeah, that's the one thing John never wanted you to think about, and the way he directed prevented you from thinking about that, whether or not you were going to take more space or whether you're going to take less space or whether this scene called for... whatever, this kind of mood or that kind of mood. He was trying to get you to get rid of all that crap. Just behave. Behave. Let me worry about it later on. And then he would cut the scene. But while you were doing it, he would do anything to stop you from thinking. He would do anything to stop you from trying to figure out, how am I going to do this? And he would never tell you anything. And the reason he wouldn't tell you anything was because he was afraid of words. He was afraid that those words would then be retranslated into some cliché.
Well, why wouldn't he tell you? He didn't want you thinking.
He didn't want you thinking. And if you start talking about what the character is feeling, you do have that danger of saying, oh, I understand now. This is how you play embarrassment. And you play it the way you've seen somebody else play it, or you have some idea of how to play it. And what usually happens is that the behavior lacks the ambiguity that most behavior has, where it's not just, there are different kinds of anger, there are different kinds of charm. They're not all the same, and there's mixtures involved at any given moment in time. And I think that's why the behavior in his picture is, to me at any rate, more interesting. So he wouldn't tell you anything.
So this threw you off balance, having technique taken away from you.
And yes. And I was off balance, and I was irritated, and I was angry, and I was afraid, and I was nervous. I was all those things. He had to break everybody down. And he did. And it was good that he did. And he was able to do it.
I want to ask you, you have a glass eye. And I think that happened when you were three. You had a tumor removed.
Yeah.
And I guess they removed your eye, too?
It was a malignant tumor.
Do you think that that's... that you've made that work for you as an actor to affect your image, to use it as something that looked menacing or that made you look more vulnerable?
Well, none of that was consciously. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only thing that I would be aware of when I was acting was try to avoid looking 100% wall-eyed. I mean, so that if you were to look in one direction and one eye went all the way to the left and the other one was still in the middle, I try to avoid that. But I have never consciously felt that, though I'll use it in some way.
Gee, could you not get shot from certain angles because your eye wouldn't move and that would be the only eye on camera?
I'm better off from the left side. I think that minimizes the wall-eyed thing.
Mm-hmm. Did kids pay you to look? You know how kids are.
That would have been good. No, they never did that. Now, when you were a kid, you know, I used to dread that moment when somebody would say, what's the matter with your eye or something like that. And there was a turning point, I don't know, when I was 12 or 13 years old. I think it had to do more with playing ball with the guys, because once you started knocking around with those guys, they were so open about it, and they would say it so freely, and it was usually a gag or a joke or knocking you or whatever the hell it is, that by then it didn't mean anything to me anymore. I was very comfortable with it.
Did it interfere with...
Because I realized, yeah. The other thing is, then I realized I could get a laugh with it.
No, did it interfere with anything that you wanted to do?
No, not at all. No, I think one of the main problems with the eye was the fact that my mother would, if I'd go play football or whatever sport, she was always nervous about it. And I always thought that was ridiculous, nothing to be nervous about. You know, when you're that age, nothing can happen to you. And then... you could always get people's attention if you took a spoon and tapped it.
Oh, gosh.
Well, the first night... I remember the first night I was in a Merchant Marine. There was this black guy from San Francisco. I think he was from Oakland. He didn't know me. I didn't know him. We just had shared this forecastle together for the first night, and... he was sitting up in the top bunk opposite me, and I came in and I sat down. It was already very, very late, and he had his pajamas on. So I started getting undressed. At that time, I had my front teeth were knocked out, and I had a removable bridge. So I took out that bridge and put it on the table. It had a nice sound effect, a little clunk when that went down. And then I popped the eye out, And then the glass hit the tabletop. That had a nice sound effect. And he's up there. He's up there watching me. And then I bent over and I started unscrewing my knee. It was a gesture, you know, where I started turning it. And it looked like I was about to remove my leg. And I'll never, I always remember him saying, "Excuse me, I'll be right back." He went somewhere, probably the men's room.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, you're very welcome.
My interview with Peter Falk was recorded in 1995. He died Thursday at the age of 83. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From Living Essentials, distributor of 5-Hour Energy, with flavors including grape, berry, and orange, in stores and at 5hourenergy.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Nineteen charter schools in the Philadelphia area are under federal investigation. Coming up, we talk with education reporter Martha Woodall about instances of fraud, abuse, and nepotism in these schools. She's been investigating charter schools for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Charter schools were created to improve education by encouraging innovation. Many charters have succeeded, but the heads of some schools have used the charters as opportunities for personal gain through fraud, mismanagement, and nepotism. In the Philadelphia area, 19 of 74 charters are under federal investigation. My guest, Martha Woodall, is an education reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. The corruption that she uncovered at charters helped lead to the federal investigation. Martha Woodall, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with the basics. What is a charter school?
Well, charter schools are publicly funded schools that are overseen by their own independent boards, and they are allowed to do things that other schools can't do. They're allowed to be flexible, and they don't have to follow all the regulations that a public school, a traditional public school, can do. But they are public schools nonetheless.
And they get taxpayer money?
totally taxpayer money. They usually get local money, state money, and most of them also get federal money.
So why were they first created, and what problems were charter schools intended to address?
Well, charter schools were began in the early 1990s. The first one, in fact, took place in Minnesota, opened in 1992. And they were the idea behind charter schools was if only educators could be free from all these regulations and laws that had been built up over the years, they could innovate, they could do creative things with teaching, and they would have better outcomes. And it was also seen as an opportunity for parents to select schools as opposed to simply sending their kid to the school a few blocks away. They could actually choose where their student would attend school. And they were, you know, to innovate and to do things better than the traditional public schools. That was the idea.
So before we get to some of the fraud and mismanagement and nepotism that you've investigated, let's talk a little bit about the success rate for innovation. Let's look at the Philadelphia area schools, which you've covered. Have the charter schools succeeded in being innovative and in having positive education outcomes?
Well, some of them certainly have, and that's one of the things that we've seen here in Philadelphia in particular, that it's been the results have been mixed. We have some extraordinarily successful charter schools here. We have a charter school here, for example, that is focused on art and architecture for high school students. So this is giving kids an opportunity to do things that they would probably not have at most traditional high schools. But overall, there have been a slew of studies, including one most recently that was and probably the most thorough that was done by researchers out of Stanford University, where they looked at Pennsylvania charter schools, and more than half of those are in Philadelphia. And they found while we had a slightly higher percentage of very good charter schools who were outperforming traditional public schools, we also had a lot more charter schools, like more than half, where the students were doing worse than the students at the school that they'd come from.
Okay. So let's look at some of the problems that charter schools have faced in the Philadelphia area where you've been investigating charter schools. Let me start by saying the charter schools are kind of like an entrepreneurial approach to education.
Right.
Where does the entrepreneurial part come in?
Well, the entrepreneurial part comes in part because they also were seeing, some of the charter advocates thought, you know, if we're going to make all the schools better, there needs to be competition. They need to compete in a marketplace, in an educational marketplace. And as a result of that kind of philosophy, they attracted a lot of people who were former business people, who wanted to get involved in education and could apply business practices to education. And I think what arose from that philosophy in too many cases, or an unfortunate number of cases, was that people were viewing these as businesses, and they were figuring out ways to make money and obtain large management fees. And a lot of the schools have accumulated large reserves, which have been used for ways that don't really enhance the outcomes for students and sometimes enrich the people at the top.
So let's look at some of the fraud that you found. Let's start with the Philadelphia Academy Charter School. What were some of the problems at this school?
Well, at this school, which was a school that was doing pretty well academically, parents at the school were disturbed, several parents in particular, that there was not money for the kinds of special services their children needed. They had mild learning difficulties. And the school kept saying, we don't have money for this. However, there was money that was being spent on all kinds of other issues. So they started going to meetings and raising questions at the trustees meeting and were basically told, we don't want you asking questions. And so ultimately what began as educational questions turned out to be that the founding CEO of the school, his successor, was alleged to have stolen almost $1 million from the school.
So the parents started investigating because they felt that the money wasn't being used where it was supposed to be used for the students. What did they find? What did you find?
Well, they began raising questions. And what we found when we started looking into it was that the existing CEO owned the vending machines in the school, used the school's money to stock up at discount stores for candy and soda, and then pocketed all the money. I mean, he was charged with skimming something like $16,000 in vending machine proceeds. He was alleged to have stolen money from the Toys for Tots campaign that the students had collected, and using money from dress down days where students paid some, like a dollar or two, not to wear uniforms, taking that money as well. They were involved in owning a building that the high school rented. They charged inflated rent amounts and then used some of that money to buy another building that was going to be used for another entity that they controlled. They misused credit cards.
Wait, let me back up with the real estate thing. So explain how that worked.
Well, they founded a nonprofit organization that bought the building that the high school then rented. And the CEO's wife, in fact, was the head of the board. And they charged really high rental rates for the school to use the building. And then they accumulated money through their higher rates to go out and buy another building, or were planning to buy another building, that was going to be used for one of the other businesses and nonprofits that were nonprofit in name only, where they were using for financial purposes as well. So they were using taxpayer money that was supposed to have gone to the school for other purposes.
So another thing you found was that the CEO of the school, and he was the second CEO, not the founding CEO, he was a high school graduate, a former Philadelphia police officer with no background in education, right?
Right. He had been briefly an uncertified shop teacher and rose through the ranks and was suddenly the CEO of the school. And that was one of the other things that the parents found most alarming, that here was someone who had no educational background who was trying to make educational decisions that were affecting the students.
So right before the founding CEO, who was no longer the CEO at this point, was about to be indicted, he killed himself.
Right, right.
How did you feel about that? Because you had investigated this story. Your investigation led to the federal investigation.
Personally, I felt terrible. I had never had anything like this happen to me as a journalist. I've been a journalist since 1973. I've written about a lot of things, but nothing that I had been involved with had led to this horrible, horrible end.
Yeah. So getting back to the school and the problems at the school, you know, we talked about the real estate deals that were inappropriate, the lack of qualifications for the CEO. There was nepotism also.
Right. Both the founding CEO and, well, primarily the second CEO had a whole lot of relatives on the payroll there who were making more money and supervising people who had far more experience and more credentials than they had. And as part of the arrangement, in order to keep the school open, the Philadelphia School District, which had approved the operating charter for this school, required the top administrators to leave and required a replacement of the board, and the board then basically fired all the relatives. That was part of the deal because they wanted to sever all ties with the families that had been involved.
So the school still exists, but under different leadership.
The school still exists under a new leadership and an entirely new board, and they have really turned things around. This happened in the spring of 2008, and they've made a lot of strides since then.
My guest is Martha Woodall. She covers education for the Philadelphia Inquirer and has done a series of articles investigating corruption in charter schools. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Martha Woodall, and she has investigated charter school fraud in Philadelphia, where she's covered education for the past 9 years for the Philadelphia Inquirer. When you look at all the charters in the Philadelphia area, do you see other patterns of fraud, financial mismanagement that you think illustrate some of the larger problems that charter schools are prone to? And this is not to condemn all charter schools, but just to say that they leave open opportunities for this kind of fraud and corruption?
Right. Nepotism, certainly. We've had cases here where large numbers of family members are on the payroll, and contracts awarded, favorable contracts to relatives and friends that include leases for luxury cars. And I think part of the problem that we have found is that the boards who are overseeing these schools are not really involved as deeply as they should be. They may only meet a few times a year. They may be friends of the CEO. That may be why they got on the board. And therefore, they're reluctant to really provide the kind of oversight that they're supposed to be providing. And I think the federal law on nonprofits has been strengthened in the last couple of years, making it clear that the people who sit on these nonprofit boards are really responsible for what happens at the nonprofits.
In talking about charter schools, you've cited several instances of fraud, abuse, mismanagement, nepotism, other questionable practices. How much oversight is there?
Well, for Philadelphia, with our charter office of 7 people, they're supposed to be keeping track of the 74 schools, and there are going to be even more schools, more charter schools in the fall to monitor. However, because of the $629 million shortfall, the School District of Philadelphia is basically cutting its administrative staff in half. And that means, as I understand it, the person who has been in charge of that office and one of the other higher-ranking people will be gone. That office will be cut in half. So there'll be like really three and a half people assigned to the charter office next year. And
responsible for like over 70
right,
schools.
Right, for 74 schools. And beyond that, the school district also has its own inspector general's office, which a lot of large public agencies do, so that if there are allegations of fraud or abuse anywhere in the school district, whether it's absconding with money from the PTO or someone misapplying funds, that office investigates. And the Philadelphia's Inspector General has been deeply involved in the charter investigations, and that office of a handful of people is going to be cut in half as well.
Are there loopholes in charter school laws that make it easier for people to get away with the kind of fraud that you've been investigating?
Well, I think one of the things is the fact that you have so few people keeping track of the charter schools. They don't have opportunities to go out and really visit the schools and pay much attention until the charters are up for renewal. So that gives several years in between where people can be getting away with things. And in this state also, charters have to send in each year a very detailed annual report about their school's operations. A copy of that goes to the charter school office. A copy of it goes to the State Department of Education. The State Department of Education puts it on a shelf. I mean, they don't really read those reports. They say it's up to the school districts who are in charge of the charters to read the reports. But given the size of the workload, it's unclear how much time the charter office has to actually read each of those reports each year.
So about 19 charter schools in Philadelphia are under federal investigation. This is Philadelphia
right,
in the suburbs.
Right.
It's a pretty high percentage.
Right, right.
Is it like this in other cities? Is Philadelphia exceptional?
Well, I think Philadelphia, there's certainly more investigations going on in Philadelphia than elsewhere. I'm not sure that Philadelphia is exceptional. I think part of the fact is that the U.S. Attorney's Office here has been really vigilant and has made charters a priority. I know that the U.S. Department of Education's Inspector General put out a report in March of 2010, basically advising U.S. attorneys across the nation that charter schools were an area where they really needed to be putting a lot of attention because there were so many opportunities for fraud. And in that case, that report found that there had been, you know, several investigations in California, and there'd been some in Texas and Ohio, but Philadelphia had the dubious distinction of having the most where there had been indictments.
Now, your paper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, did an amazing series a couple of months ago about violence in the Philadelphia public schools. And it was really a harrowing series with attacks, describing attacks on students and teachers by students.
Right.
Is that just in the public schools? Is that going on in the charters as well?
I don't believe it's going on in the charters to that extent. At least I've not heard that. In fact, part of the reason why charters have expanded and grown so much in Philadelphia is parents have the perception that the charter schools are safer. And I think in many cases they are, because charters can kind of although they're supposed to be following due process procedures, if a student is violent, it's certainly easier to remove the students who are causing trouble at a charter school, and they wind up back at the traditional schools. But parents are, even if a school is not necessarily performing very well academically, they may choose to put their child in a charter school because they have a perception things are safer.
And you say that perception is probably accurate.
Mm-hmm. At least as far as we know.
As you know, there's a running debate about whether the charter schools are hurting the public schools or not. The argument that they're hurting schools goes something like this, that the charter schools are taking the most gifted students away from the public schools, and they're taking the students who have the most incentive and whose parents have the most incentive to get a good education, and those people are pursuing charter schools. So while the charter schools are getting the best students, they also are dumping the most problematic students back into the public schools because they can. The regulations are more flexible for expelling students. So if you measure back to back the performance of the charter schools and the public schools, the charter schools have an inherent advantage. So having covered public schools and charter schools over the past 9 years, do you have any thoughts on whether the charter schools are creating problems for the public schools or not, whether they're putting public schools at a disadvantage, whether they're depleting the public school system?
I think that certainly there's an advantage that comes from having a parent who is active and engaged enough to have made a decision to place a student in a charter school. I think that's probably an inherent advantage because, as we know, the lack of parental involvement is one of the biggest issues facing traditional public schools. But at the same time, I think where the argument is in terms of perhaps undermining public schools, has the most merit has to do with the finances. And I know that charter advocates point out, well, the money is following the student. It's public money that doesn't harm the traditional public schools because they're not educating that student. Well, that's true to an extent. A lot of the charter school students maybe never attended traditional public schools. Sometimes they come out of the non-public school world and they're entering. This is the first time their education is being funded by taxpayers. In addition to that, since most charters, at least in Philadelphia, for example, they're not just neighborhood schools, they draw from throughout the city. You're picking one student from this zip code, one student from that zip code, and putting them in a charter school classroom. That doesn't really mean that any of the sending schools can close a classroom because they're not coming in neat 25 to 30 student allotments, and for that reason, that it's the resources are being diminished for the traditional public schools.
So you have less money per classroom,
right,
in a lot,
right,
of places.
Right, right.
My guest is Martha Woodall. She covers education for the Philadelphia Inquirer and has done a series of articles investigating corruption in charter schools. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest is Martha Woodall, an education reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, who has written extensively about fraud in charter schools. 19 charters in the Philadelphia area are under federal investigation.
Looking at the big picture, how would you say the reality of charter schools compares to the vision of charter schools in the early 1990s when they were created?
I think that some have clearly met the goals of experimentation and better student outcomes and opportunities for parents to choose. But I think that a lot of people would say that in terms of the academic outcomes, it hasn't been as dramatic an improvement overall nationwide as had been anticipated.
What about the most innovative schools? Have we seen in some charter schools, like specialized schools for art and architecture or science, that these charter schools are coming up with models that could be applied to other schools, including public schools?
Right. I think that's absolutely true. Here in Philadelphia, we have a charter organization that began with one school here that's now expanded to a lot of other schools, and it's the Mastery Charter Schools, and they've been enormously successful. And they have also managed to be successful. They have raised additional money. So they're able to actually – they have a lot of grant money and private foundation support so that they're actually able to spend more on services for students than the traditional public schools. And their approach is not only a strong, rigorous college prep background that has been successful. They have also – develop this whole emotional and social learning curriculum that is part of the student's growth and performance that really deals with, like, character and how people behave. And in terms of discipline, they use a restorative justice practice. And I think those kinds of approaches have helped them be academically successful.
So the school that you were just talking about is called?
Mastery Charter Schools.
And is that the school that Oprah Winfrey gave
$1 million to? Yes, her Angel Network gave them $1 million last year. And they have received some federal grants as well and some other private funds to really expand. And they're involved now, after having had one of their own successful high school charter schools, they have been involved in doing turnarounds for the Philadelphia School District, where they take really troubled schools and turn them into charters. And they started doing this several years ago. And they last year they had one of the first graduation for one of their turnaround schools, where they go from 7 to 12. And their students, they had more than 90% of their students going to college in neighborhoods where fewer than 20% of the students from the traditional public high schools were going to college.
What's the moral of that story?
Well, there again, they have this whole approach involving the social and emotional learning. They have a longer school day, a longer school year. They have mentors. They provide mentors for the high school students, and they are required to conduct like high school internships. I mean, they have like a very complete philosophical program that has worked out really very well for them. And they're also among the schools where the teachers actually are paid at a better rate. They work hard for their money, but they tend to be paid better than the traditional public schools.
Okay. Martha Woodall, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, Terry.
Martha Woodall covers education for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You'll find a link to her series about charter schools on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, why so many tomatoes, especially in the winter, are tasteless. They're bred for hardness to withstand trucking, picked when still firm and green, and artificially gassed with ethylene until they turn red. We talk with Barry Estabrook, author of Tomatoland. He won a James Beard Award this year for his blog, Politics of the Plate. Join us.